Chapter 29. Unknown Unknowns. A lost advanced civilization of the Ice Age, with global navigational and map-making skills equivalent to our own in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, would have had the capacity to establish outposts on every continent, but must also have had a homeland. Since that homeland has not been found, after 200 years of diligent archaeology, most diligent archaeologists conclude, quite reasonably on the face of things, that it did not exist. But there are other options. It might be underwater now. The immense Sunda Shelf around Indonesia, for example, submerged by sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age. It might be under ice, perhaps in Antarctica, if we're willing to accept that some rather extraordinary geophysical events occurred in the past 100,000 years. It might await rediscovery in the unexplored heart of the Amazon rainforest. It might lie beneath the sands of the Sahara Desert. Or perhaps its homeland has all along remained hidden in plain view, in the very last place that anyone has thought to look, North America. There are surprisingly few known knowns in American prehistoric archaeology, and good reasons why there are so many known unknowns, reasons that in turn suggest that the third Rumsfeldian category of unknown unknowns, the things we don't know, may ultimately prove to be far larger and more significant than either of the other two. First and foremost, the Younger Dryas impacts and subsequent sustained cataclysm changed the face of the Earth completely and wrought particularly significant havoc across North America. We have considered the question of huge volumes of meltwater released into the Arctic and Atlantic oceans from the destabilized ice sheet and looked at the effects on global climate. But keep in mind that those enormous floods also devastated the rich North American mainland to the south, perhaps the best and most bounteous real estate then available anywhere. This immense and extraordinary deluge, described as possibly the largest flood in the history of the world, swept away and utterly demolished everything that lay in its path. Jostling with icebergs, choked by whole forests ripped up by their roots, turbulent with mud and boulders swirling in the depths of the current, what the deluge left behind can still be seen in something of its raw form in the channeled scablands of the state of Washington today. A devastated blank slate, described at length in Magicians of the Gods, littered with 10,000-ton glacial erratics, immense fossilized waterfalls, and current ripples hundreds of feet long and dozens of feet high. If there were cities there before the deluge, they would be gone. If there was any evidence of anything that we would recognize as technology there before the deluge, it would be gone. And if an advanced antediluvian civilization had flourished anywhere within 500 kilometers of the southern edge of the ice cap, not only in the channeled scablands, but all the way along the ice margin, the flood alone might have been sufficient to ensure that not a trace of it would be left for archaeologists to misrepresent 12,800 years later. Washington displays flood-ravaged scablands, but so too does New Jersey much further to the east. Washington is notable for its fields and hillsides, strewn with huge ice-rafted erratics, but so too is the state of New York. Interestingly also, just as Washington has its coulees, New York State has its Finger Lakes. These latter were long thought to have been carved by glaciers, but their geomorphology closely parallels that of the coulees of the channeled scablands, and some researchers now believe they were cut by glacial meltwater at extreme pressures, a process linked by sediment evidence to the collapse of continental ice sheets. Likewise in Minnesota, on the St. Croix River, there is a spectacular array of more than 80 giant glacial potholes. One is 10 feet wide and 60 feet deep, making it the deepest explored pothole in the world. Others, as yet unexcavated, are even wider and probably deeper as well. And all of them, without exception, were formed by turbulent floods at the end of the Ice Age. We are looking, then, at vast expanses of North America that were literally scoured. And this is before we get to the other effects of the Younger Dryas impacts explored in previous chapters, including direct hits on populated areas, searing heat and shockwaves from airbursts, continent-wide wildfires, an impact winter, icy ejecta, and so on and so forth. All in all, if North America is where a lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity vanished, then by far the most significant problem we face in investigating it is the way that the crime scene was systematically wiped down by the cataclysmic events at the onset of the Younger Dryas. Wiping down the crime scene. Conquest. The European invasion of the American mainland began 500 years ago with the Spanish conquest of Mexico. In 1519, when Hernán Cortés first set foot on the shores of the Yucatán, more than 30 million people lived in Mexico. A century later, after the brutal genocide of the conquest itself and immense loss of life to smallpox epidemics, the population had fallen to just 3 million. The entire pre-Columbian literature of Mexico, a vast library of tens of thousands of codices, was carefully and systematically destroyed by the priests and friars who followed in the wake of the conquistadors. In November 1530, for example, Bishop Juan de Zumarraga, who had shortly before been appointed protector of the Indians by the Spanish crown, proceeded to protect his flock by burning at the stake a Mexican aristocrat, the lord of the city of Texcoco, whom he accused of having worshipped the rain god. In the city's marketplace, Zumarraga had a pyramid formed of the documents of Aztec history, knowledge and literature, their paintings, manuscripts and hieroglyphic writings, all of which he committed to the flames, while the natives cried and prayed. More than 30 years later, the Holocaust of documents was still underway. In July 1562, in the main square of Mani, just south of modern Mérida in the Yucatán, Bishop Diego de Landa burned thousands of Maya codices, story paintings, and hieroglyphs inscribed on rolled-up deerskins. He boasted of destroying countless idols and altars, all of which he described as works of the devil, designed by the evil one to delude the Indians and to prevent them from accepting Christianity. Noting that the Maya used certain characters or letters which they wrote in their books about the antiquities and their sciences, he informs us, "We found a great number of books in these letters, and since they contained nothing but superstitions and falsehoods of the devil, we burned them all, which they took most grievously, and which gave them great pain." Any of us today, interested in the truth about the past, can share the pain of those horrified Native Americans. For what, we cannot help but wonder, was written in their lost books concerning the antiquities and sciences of the ancients? What exactly went up in smoke there? I have explored the mysteries of the Maya and of their predecessors, the Olmec, in my earlier work, so I have not retold their extraordinary story here. I will mention in passing, however, that in 1998, long before I knew of the Mississippi Valley civilization and its afterlife beliefs concerning the constellation Orion and the Milky Way, I drew attention in Heaven's Mirror to a discovery by archaeologists Jose Fernandez and Robert Cormack establishing that the settlement core of the Maya city of Utatlan was designed according to a celestial scheme reflected by the shape of the constellation of Orion. Fernandez was also able to prove that all of Utatlan's major temples were oriented to the heliacal setting points of stars in Orion, and noted that the Milky Way, alongside which Orion stands, was thought of as a celestial path connecting the firmament's navel with the center of the underworld. This should be familiar territory to the listener by now, and hopefully you can guess what comes next. Very much like the ancient Egyptians I reported in Heaven's Mirror, the Maya regarded the Milky Way as a particularly important feature of the heavens. They conceived of it as the road that led to their netherworld, Xibalba, which in common with other Central American peoples, they located in the sky. I also commented on Mexican traditions of the post-mortem journey of the soul, in which the deceased just as in the ancient Egyptian Duat, would face a series of ordeals and a final judgment in the terrifying presence of the death god. Noting numerous other striking similarities in beliefs and symbolism around the mysteries of death and the afterlife, I concluded, in Egypt, as amongst the Maya, the stellar context involves Orion and the Milky Way. In Egypt, as in Mexico, a journey through the netherworld must be undertaken by the deceased. In Egypt, as in Mexico, religious teachings assert that life is our opportunity to prepare for this journey, an opportunity that should, under no circumstances, be wasted. Such correspondences led me to speculate that both ancient Egypt and ancient Mexico had shared in the legacy of an even more ancient cosmological religion, wrapped up in sophisticated astronomical observations and specifically focused on the afterlife journey of the soul. Neither Egypt nor Mexico had originated this religion, nor had they transmitted it directly to one another. Rather, each of them had inherited it from a third, as yet unidentified civilization. It was a hypothesis. What could help to strengthen it, and perhaps even confirm it, would be evidence of other civilizations, with no direct relationship, in which the same legacy could be identified. This evidence, I submit, now exists in the astonishing proximity of the religious beliefs, iconography, and symbolism of the Mississippi Valley to the religious beliefs, iconography, and symbolism of ancient Egypt, outlined in Part 6. These deep, structural connections are, in my view, unexplainable by any means other than a shared legacy from a very ancient source, a source predating the separation of peoples when the Americas became isolated from the old world by the rising oceans at the end of the Ice Age. Let's take a brief look at the most ancient Native American book still in existence, the Dresden Codex, so-called because it's kept in a museum in the German city of Dresden. It is a thought-provoking document for many reasons, not least the scientific character of the mathematics and astronomy incorporated in it. For example, the eminent Mayanist Sylvanus Griswold Morley noticed that on pages 51 to 58 of the Codex, 405 revolutions of the moon are set down, and so accurate are the calculations involved, that although they cover a period of nearly 33 years, the total number of days recorded, 11,959, is only 89/100th of a day less than the true time computed by the best modern method. Also of great interest is the way that numbers set out in the Dresden Codex keep on getting longer and longer in the final pages, until, in the so-called serpent numbers, a grand total of nearly 12.5 million days, 34,000 years, is recorded again and again. Finally, on the last page of the manuscript, is depicted the destruction of the world, for which these highest numbers have paved the way. Here we see the rain serpent stretching across the sky, belching forth torrents of water. Great streams of water gush from the sun and the moon. The old goddess, she of the tiger claws and forbidding aspect, the malevolent patroness of floods and cloudbursts, overturns the bowl of the heavenly waters. The crossbones, dread emblem of death, decorate her skirt, and a writhing snake crowns her head. Below, with downward-pointing spears symbolic of the universal destruction, the black god stalks abroad, a screeching bird raging on his fearsome head. Here, indeed, is portrayed with graphic touch the final, all-engulfing cataclysm. It's curious, this mixture of science, cataclysm, and time. Calculations far into the past, or lesser probings of the future, occur in many a Maya hieroglyphic text, notes archaeologist J. Eric S. Thompson. On a stela at Quirigua, a date over 90 million years ago is computed. On another, a date over 300 million years before that is given. These are actual computations, stating correctly day and month positions, and are comparable to calculations in our calendar, giving the month positions on which Easter would have fallen at equivalent distances in the past. The brain reels at such astronomical figures, Yet these reckonings were of sufficient frequency and importance to require special hieroglyphs for their transcription. All that can be said for sure is that embedded in the Mayan material, together with core religious beliefs very similar to those of the ancient Egyptians, and now we know very similar to those of the ancient Mississippians also, is evidence of an interest in complex scientific calculations and immense expanses of time. I'm reminded of the passage from the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, quoted in Chapter 3, in which the sun god Ra is praised for his travels through the untold spaces of the cosmic void, requiring millions and hundreds of thousands of years to pass over, a chronology on a similar order to the Mayan scheme of things, but one would have thought irrelevant to the concerns of agricultural societies. And the same goes for the immense geometrical mounds and enclosures of the ancient Egyptian Duat that are matched by the immense geometrical mounds and enclosures of the Hopewell of Ohio and the immense geometrical mounds and enclosures now emerging from the Amazon rainforest. What the evidence suggests to me is that something extraordinary, something that the theories of mainstream archaeology cannot account for, was going on behind the scenes of prehistory. All the indications are that Mexico, with its ancient tradition of literacy, was once a vast archive of the antiquities and sciences of former times, and that the records the Spaniards destroyed in their zealous stupidity may have been as integral to the memory of humanity as the Library of Alexandria. I think it is very possible, had the Mayan documents survived in sufficient quantities, that they would have shed light on the mystery of the lost common source of inspiration that appears to have kick-started civilizations in both the Old World and the New. In the event, however, out of tens of thousands of Mayan codices in existence in 1519, just four are still with us in the 21st century. After the Spanish conquest of Mexico, the conquest of Peru soon followed, again accompanied by the destruction of a high civilization, in this case the Inca, in the lineage of the first Americans. Though they had their quipus, a means of communication and calculation using knotted string, the Inca were not a literate people like the Maya, and thus possessed no documents for the Spaniards to destroy. As in Mexico, however, a sustained and determined effort was made to stamp out local religions and traditions and replace them with Roman Catholicism. Once again, this effort, officially sanctioned as the extirpation of idolatry, called for cultural destruction on a grand scale, calculated to erase the memory banks of the population within a generation or two and replace their deep connection to their own past with the new dispensation. The Spaniards did venture into North America, of course, most eccentrically and unproductively, in the form of an expedition led by Hernando de Soto, who landed in Florida in 1539, with more than 600 men. After losing half his force along the way, de Soto spent the next 3 years, until his own death in Louisiana in 1542, wandering all over the southeast and deep south of what is now the United States, passing many of the great mound sites and engaging in ruinous pitched battles with the locals. The most disastrous byproduct of his visit, however, may have been smallpox, which his expeditionaries appear to have brought with them and which afterward devastated the indigenous population of the region. We may say, therefore, that from its earliest days, the European conquest of the Americas was an agent of chaos, genocide, and cultural extinction for Native Americans, and that this, too, was very much part of the process that wiped down the crime scene, leaving us scratching our heads, trying to make sense of the few clues left behind. Wiping down the crime scene. Witness amnesia. The extirpation of vital evidence concerning the past of our species across huge swathes of the Americas was by no means limited to the effects of the Younger Dryas cataclysm or to the subsequent much later cataclysms of militant Christianity and smallpox. Once the calamitous century of the initial encounters was over, a more insidious but equally deadly process of erosion began to grind down the little of the past that the previous millennia had spared. During the 16th century, apart from a few failed raids like De Soto's, North America was not much affected. But from the early 17th century onward, following the first European settlements in Virginia and Massachusetts, everything changed. Thereafter, with monotonous, depressing regularity, either for their agricultural potential or for the prospect of gold, lands held sacred in the possession of Native American tribes for aeons were snatched from them and their inhabitants driven off or slaughtered. These murderous land grabs only accelerated and became crueler as the 17th century was followed by the 18th and as the 18th century rolled on into the 19th. From the time Europeans arrived on American shores, the frontier, the edge territory between white man's civilization and the untamed natural world, became a shared space of vast clashing differences that led the U.S. government to authorize over 1,500 wars, attacks, and raids on Indians, the most of any country in the world against its indigenous people. By the close of the Indian Wars in the late 19th century, fewer than 238,000 indigenous people remained, a sharp decline from the estimated 5 million to 15 million living in North America when Columbus arrived in 1492. In his important book, American Holocaust, which documents the genocide, David Stannard, professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, reminds us that scholarly estimates of the size of the pre-Columbian population of the Americas have changed radically in recent decades. In the 1940s and 1950s, he writes, conventional wisdom held that the population of the entire hemisphere in 1492 was little more than 8 million, with fewer than 1 million people living in the region north of present-day Mexico. Today, few serious students of the subject would put the hemispheric figure at less than 75 million to 100 million, with approximately 8 million to 12 million north of Mexico, while one of the most well-regarded specialists in the field recently has suggested that a more accurate estimate would be around 145 million for the hemisphere as a whole and about 18 million for the area north of Mexico. Gone forever, and good riddance, is the long-held myth of North America as a pristine wilderness inhabited by a handful of savages when the first settlers from Europe arrived. Nothing could be further from the truth. The new picture, derived from a combination of archaeology, ethnography, genetics, and the reports of early travelers, is of a busy and boisterous continent with a growing population, widespread trade networks, and abundant resources. Like the Inca, though lacking their centralized, structured state, the native North Americans were people of the spoken word, who carried their wisdom and their records not in documents, but in oral traditions, carefully nurtured, memorized, and passed on from generation to generation. Today we grope in the dark when we try to discover what they knew, what they taught, and what they had preserved from primeval times, because the genocide inflicted upon them radically disrupted and in many cases completely destroyed the normal intergenerational processes of transmission. The accounts of the genocide are repulsive. Reading the details today leaves one stunned, nauseated, and horrified. Professor Stannard holds nothing back in American Holocaust, a comprehensive record of European wickedness in the Americas. But it's not my purpose here to zoom in on the many massacres and betrayals he describes, or to dwell on the horrific symptoms of the imported infectious diseases that killed indigenous people by the millions. The point I wish to make is simply that this happened, that it was both physical and cultural genocide, and that its long-term effect on the descendants of those who survived was to sever their connections to the traditions, wisdom, memories, and even the languages of their ancestors. Lest there be any doubt that cultural annihilation was always the purpose, hand in hand with the continent-wide theft of land, we need only consider the shameful history of the so-called Indian boarding schools. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition sets out the bare facts. Between 1869 and the 1960s, hundreds of thousands of Native American children were removed from their homes and families and placed in boarding schools operated by the federal government and the churches. Though we don't know how many children were taken in total, by 1926, the Indian Office estimated that nearly 83% of Indian children were attending boarding schools. The U.S. Native children that were voluntarily or forcibly removed from their homes, families, and communities during this time were taken to schools far away, where they were punished for speaking their native language, banned from acting in any way that might be seen to represent traditional or cultural practices, stripped of traditional clothing, hair, and personal belongings and behaviors reflective of their native culture. A founder and advocate of the boarding schools movement, U.S. Army Captain Richard Henry Pratt, summarized the spirit of the whole enterprise in a speech in 1892. "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead. Kill the Indian in him and save the man." This, then, was an ethnically targeted brainwashing exercise on a gigantic scale, an exercise deliberately designed to make Native Americans forget their ancient heritage. For the purposes of our inquiry here, if it were indeed from North America that a lost civilization vanished, then not only has the crime scene been thoroughly wiped down, but also, to extend the analogy, the principal witnesses have been badly beaten about the head and are suffering from amnesia. Wiping down the crime scene, land grabs. Even as the genocide and imposed unremembering gathered pace during the 19th and 20th centuries, a parallel force was also active, removing many prominent physical traces, notably the great mounds and earthworks, that Native Americans of former ages had left. This parallel force was primarily greed for land, where the fate of the monuments was either to be plowed down for agriculture or demolished to make way for industry, housing, or commerce. Among the unknown unknowns of North American prehistory, therefore, is how many of the mounds and earthworks were already gone, plowed under, demolished, ransacked, before responsible and thorough surveyors began to investigate them from about the mid-19th century onwards. Renowned among these early surveyors were Ephraim Squire and Edwin Davis, whose classic Ancient Monuments of the Mississippi Valley, the first ever publication of the Smithsonian Institution, appeared in print in 1848. In their preface, they note of the mounds and earthworks that the importance of a complete and speedy examination of the whole field cannot be overestimated. The operations of the elements, the shifting channels of the streams, the leveling hand of public improvement, and most efficient of all, the slow but constant encroachments of agriculture, are fast destroying these monuments of ancient labor, breaking in upon their symmetry and obliterating their outlines. Thousands have already disappeared, or retain but slight and doubtful traces of their former proportions. One of the reasons that ancient monuments is still useful today is that it provides the locations of many important mounds and earthworks that no longer exist. In 2011, in a paper published in American Antiquity, Gerald Birks and Robert Cook looked into the specific case of Ohio, where Squire and Davis had reported approximately 88 earthwork sites in 1848. Perhaps because of the fame brought to them by ancient monuments, 16 of these sites, 18% of the total, are now preserved whole or in part within parks. Another 18 sites, 20%, are mostly or completely destroyed, with urban development and gravel mining being the primary destructive processes. The remaining 54 sites, 62%, are now invisible at the surface. So, to summarize, out of 88 Ohio sites put on record in 1848 by Squire and Davis, 54 are now invisible, 18 more are destroyed, and only 16, just 18% of the total, are still in place, implying an effective loss of 82%, or in plain English, 82 out of every 100 sites. What then are we to make of David J. Meltzer's presumably authoritative introduction to the 150th anniversary reissue of Ancient Monuments, which informs us that Ohio's Ross County alone was estimated by Squire and Davis in 1848 to contain 100 enclosures and 500 mounds? If that's the correct figure, then all the other numbers change. 16 sites remaining out of 600 is quite a different matter from 16 out of 88 and amounts to a 97% loss. On July 23, 2018, wanting to get to the bottom of this, I emailed Jarrod Burks, co-author of the 2011 Antiquity paper. His first point was to remind me that the focus in his paper was not on earthworks in Ohio in general, but only on those depicted in Squire and Davis, 88 sites. There are many hundreds of earthwork sites, those with enclosures, in Ohio, and we keep finding more. As to the specific issue of the discrepancy between Meltzer's figures and his own, Burks explained, I was counting actually sites with enclosures depicted in maps in Squire and Davis. This comes from individual maps of sites, like the map of High Bank Works, and from unique sites depicted on their composite maps of select areas, like the area around Chillicothe. For example, they show the Steel Group site on that map, but they do not have a separate, more detailed map of steel. So when I say enclosure site, I'm referring to places with 1 through X enclosures. Hopewell Mound Group is one site, though it has several enclosures. Cedar Bank is one site that has only one enclosure. Following this approach, Squire and Davis depict 88 sites with enclosures in their maps. There is no way there are 100 enclosure sites in Ross County, but there may be 100 enclosures. So far, I have only found solid evidence for 37 to 38 enclosure sites in Ross County, and this includes some previously undocumented ones we have found in aerial photos and subsequently surveyed with geophysics. In fact, most of the 37 to 38 have been surveyed, still working on getting access to a few of them. The Archaeological Atlas of Ohio, William C. Mills, 1914, reports 586 enclosure sites in Ohio. Many of these are unconfirmed and/or lost since 1914, but we are working to find many of them. We have also found more not recorded in 1914, so the total number of enclosure sites once in Ohio conservatively is 500 to 1,000. It could be double or more. I had also asked Burks if he knew where I might find estimates of the sort that he had made in Ohio for the Mississippi Valley as a whole, that is, how many mounds and earthworks remain and how many have been destroyed since the mid-19th century. Getting numbers for all of the Mississippi Valley is a daunting task, he replied, especially if you include mounds. There were many tens of thousands of mounds in the eastern U.S. You might start by contacting the State Historic Preservation Office in each state. I was surprised that no archaeologist had yet done this basic legwork, and that there was no authoritative volume or paper I could immediately be referred to, since presumably at least some measure of what has been lost must be fundamental to the correct assessment of what remains. I therefore asked for confirmation that I would be representing the facts correctly if I were to tell my readers that reliable figures simply don't exist for the whole Mississippi Valley, and that no archaeologist or other researcher has ever attempted to estimate what has been lost across the whole region as a result of agricultural, industrial, and other encroachments since the mid-19th century. Burks replied immediately, "That's a pretty broad statement. I don't know that no archaeologist or other researcher has done that. George Milner produced a book on mounds 10 to 15 years ago. Perhaps he makes a statement like that, but I doubt it, given how nearly impossible it is to track that. For example, in Ohio, we say there were once 10,000 plus mounds, a 19th century estimate. The state has only about 2,000 that have been recorded in the modern list. Many have been destroyed, but we are constantly recording new ones, many of which likely were known in the 19th century. So, hard to put numbers on it, but it's true that many, many mounds have been destroyed." George R. Milner's book, The Mound Builders, arrived on my desk the following morning, but contains no information that adds significantly to what we already know about the loss of mound sites since the 19th century. Nor was David Meltzer able to come up with a figure. observing in reply to my query that 200-plus years ago, there was no systematic count of these earthworks, so we have no idea what the denominator should be for the equation of sites still extant, sites once present. The good news is that sites are still being discovered, or probably more often rediscovered. The bad news is that it may be nearly impossible to track the many, many that have been destroyed. All estimates are guesswork, but I suspect that Gregory Little's diligent and thoroughly researched Illustrated Encyclopedia of Native American Mounds and Earthworks, though not a mainstream source, is close to the truth when it calculates that 90% of all the Mississippi Valley sites have been destroyed, and that only 10% remain. And lest such a ballpark figure should sound too extreme, let us remember, despite the conservationist rhetoric of our supposedly more enlightened age, that mounds and earthworks are still being destroyed in the 21st century. Walmart seems to have a penchant for this. In 2001, for example, the Fenton Mounds, a pair of Native American burial mounds in Fenton, Missouri, dated between AD 600 and 1400, were leveled to make way for a Walmart supercenter. A few years later, in August 2009, city leaders in Oxford, Alabama, approved the destruction of a 1,500-year-old Native American ceremonial mound because, once again, Walmart wanted the location. The developers began work, removing a substantial section of the mound, but a month later, following a public outcry, the media reported a change of heart. A reconsecration ceremony was held this past weekend at a damaged Indian mound in Oxford, Alabama. The 1,500-year-old sacred and archaeologically significant site was partially demolished during a taxpayer-funded economic development project, with the excavated dirt to be used as fill for construction of a Sam's Club, a retail warehouse store owned by Walmart. What's indicated here is a state of mind across a segment of the American population that sees no inherent cultural value in antiquities and believes firmly that the past has nothing to teach us that outweighs our need for yet another large store. I don't mean to pick on Americans. Exactly the same state of mind exists in Britain, France, China, and virtually every other country in the world. By encouraging disdain for the past, however, the cost of such an outlook in fast-growing America since the 19th century has been the mass destruction of ancient sites, notably including the loss of many thousands of the mounds and earthworks of the Mississippi Valley. Exactly how many thousands will probably remain a known unknown forever, but whatever the true number, it represents yet another level at which the crime scene of ancient America has been wiped down. Wiping down the crime scene. Bad archaeology. Those of us who explore alternative approaches to prehistory are frequently accused by archaeologists and their friends in the media of being pseudoscientists. What, however, could provide a better example of truly damaging and misleading pseudoscience than the Clovis First paradigm that ruled American archaeology for more than 40 years, with a wholly false doctrine taught to generations of students as fact? We heard in part two how this pseudoscientific theory of the peopling of the Americas, based on wildly irresponsible extrapolations from tiny data sets, yet promoted by a powerful lobby of leading archaeologists, was for a very long while held to be so right, so correct, and so self-evidently true that any researchers who questioned it faced ridicule, ostracism by their colleagues, withdrawal of research grants, and ruined careers. This kind of behavior in scholarship not only fails to serve the truth, but actively undermines the search for it, and as such, has also played a significant part in wiping down the ancient American crime scene. How much was missed, and has since been built over or plowed under during those 40-plus years, when it was considered heresy to investigate deposits older than Clovis for signs of a human presence? And how much wide-ranging and open-minded investigation into the true age and origins of the first Americans was postponed or entirely nipped in the bud at the same time? How many unexplored avenues do we owe to the absurd Clovis First dogma? How many doors did it close on how many promising initiatives? And how much public interest and curiosity in other possibilities did the path answer Clovis First snuff out? It's been the same problem with another archaeological theory, the so-called Pleistocene overkill theory, whereby all the megafauna were supposedly slaughtered by those same ruthlessly efficient Clovis hunters, who nevertheless proved insufficiently ruthless and efficient to survive the Younger Dryas onset. I've not gone into the details here, just too much academic bickering to impose upon the listener. But this theory also, though not yet quite as dead as Clovis First, since it still has some advocates, has been conclusively rejected by increasing numbers of scholars in recent years. Although he lists archaeology and North American prehistory among his fields of study, Terry Jones, professor and department chair of social sciences at California Polytechnic State University, brings the benefit of an outsider's perspective when he observes the Paleo-Indian period, often defined as anything predating 10,000 calendar years before the present, is basically the domain of a small number of specialists who interpret it for everyone else. For the last 40 years, these researchers have focused their interpretations on two closely related and intricately interconnected theories, Clovis First and Pleistocene Overkill. During this time, Paleo-Indian research has also deteriorated into an intense, if not hostile, debate over these two competing but not mutually exclusive ideas. Much of the energy in this protracted dialogue has been devoted to debunking or nullifying alternative hypotheses associated with these two theories. While this is standard practice in science, the degree to which the Paleo-Indian debate has been focused on deconstruction of opposing ideas rather than development of empirically solid new ones has been extreme. This, too, is part of the wiping down of the North American crime scene. Some limited, but perhaps case-breaking clues to what really happened here around 12,800 years ago may remain. To the extent that the detectives involved in this paleo CSI are more interested in ego contests than the truth, however, the truth may take a very long time to emerge. Besides, there's another aspect to the problem in the visceral resistance shown by a number of influential scholars to any suggestion that a cataclysm of any kind ushered in the onset of the Younger Dryas. These scholars themselves apparently believe, and so far as possible would like us to believe, that nothing really bad happened at the Younger Dryas boundary, that yes, there were extinctions, and yes, Clovis abruptly disappeared, but there is no mystery here, just a fairly routine and predictable combination of overkill and climate change. Terry Jones, a member of the Comet Research Group, refutes such reasoning at length in a paper in the Journal of Cosmology and strongly advocates the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, which he points out has been introduced into North American archaeology at a time when the failings of the overkill model have been acknowledged by the majority of researchers. Alternatives to overkill have long been focused on climate change associated with the Pleistocene-Holocene transition. But this idea has always been problematic because large animal populations had lived through previous interglacials without massive die-offs. Something different seems to have happened in North America at the end of the Pleistocene, and that something was not a blitzkrieg by human hunters. An extraterrestrial impact event seems to provide an exceptionally parsimonious explanation for a variety of patterns in the archaeological and paleontological records that are not accommodated by overkill. In the crosshairs. Another pattern for which the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis provides a parsimonious explanation is formed by the deep structural connections demonstrated in Part 6 between the spiritual beliefs and astrogeometry of the ancient Egyptians and the spiritual beliefs and astrogeometry of the ancient Mississippians. The case I've sought to make throughout this book is that these two river valley civilizations were among several in the ancient world that inherited a shared legacy of knowledge and ideas from an earlier lost civilization. Regardless of when that legacy was activated or how its integrity was preserved over the many generations before it first manifests in the archaeological record, I've argued that its origins go back to the last ice age and predate the physical separation of the old world from the new. The additional element of parsimony that the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis brings to this case, therefore, comes in the form of the impact-related earth changes documented at the Younger Dryas boundary. These involved not only radical climate change and sea level rise, not only global wildfires and a subsequent impact winter, not only mass extinctions of large animal species and the abrupt disappearance of Clovis, but also, in the combination of all these ills, a realistic mechanism, deadly, substantial, drastic, and sustained enough to devastate and destroy even a technologically advanced civilization. If a disaster on such a scale were to recur today, our civilization would not survive it, and all our works would crumble into ruin within a few millennia. I therefore see no reason in principle why the global cataclysm indicated in the Greenland ice cores that we know unfolded at the onset of the Younger Dryas between 12,836 and 12,815 years ago should not have brought an end to that previous high civilization of the early primeval age of the gods, the civilization of the ancient ones, the civilization of the first time that is recalled with awe in myths and traditions from all around the world. Although there were significant impacts in Greenland, the Pacific, South America, Antarctica, Europe, and the Near East, the evidence points conclusively toward North America as the epicenter of the Younger Dryas cataclysm, and to the North American ice cap specifically as the target for the largest swarm of comet fragments. Almost by default, therefore, although the crime scene has been brutally compromised, and although the lead investigators have a priori ruled the possibility out, North America is the most likely location on Earth where a civilization could have thrived during the Ice Age and been destroyed at the onset of the Younger Dryas. Not only that, if the Edfu texts contain a record of these events, as I have proposed, then we should take seriously the message they transmit, that there were survivors of the cataclysm who made it their mission to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods, the recreation of a destroyed world. These survivors are said to have wandered the earth, setting out and building sacred mounds wherever they went, and teaching the fundamentals of civilization, including religion, agriculture, and architecture. In Heaven's Mirror, 1998, I speculate that it is perhaps as a result of their efforts that we find the basic doctrines of the same sky-ground religion, essentially the same beliefs about the afterlife journey of the soul, and the same architectural and geometrical principles as far afield as South America, Easter Island, Micronesia, Japan, Cambodia, India, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Malta, Spain, and Britain. Because the Earth is a sphere, it is technically true that any point could be selected as central to the radiation of these ideas. As I've been researching this book, however, my perspective has changed, and what I see now when I look at the globe are two great oceans, the Atlantic on one side and the Pacific on the other, with the longitudinal sprawl of the Americas running between them and forming, literally, the center of the world. North America, we now know, was scoured, burned, frozen, and flooded by the Younger Dryas cataclysm, and has since been systematically ransacked by Western greed and poorly served by Western scholars. Although less severely affected by the impacts of the Younger Dryas, South America also suffered all these assaults. And just as in North America, where millions of square kilometers have been rendered opaque to archaeologists because the crime scene has been so successfully wiped down, so too in South America, we have 5 million square kilometers of the Amazon rainforest that remain almost as unfamiliar to archaeology as the dark side of the moon. The two great continents of the Americas are not separate and have never been separate, either before or after the Ice Age. North America is, in itself, a huge landmass, with vast regions where little or no archaeology has ever been done. If a lost civilization was here in the Ice Age, we cannot rule out the possibility that its physical artifacts and remains might yet be found. Given that many Native American cultures share myths of the destruction of a former world, a subterranean interval in the womb of the earth, and then an emergence into our present world, the most fruitful direction in which to look might be for places of shelter and refuge deep underground. The other region with immense scope for further inquiry is the Amazon. When North America passed through that cataclysmic episode between 12,836 and 12,815 years ago, South America would have seemed like the obvious place for survivors of the lost civilization to take refuge. This would have been all the more likely if, as I speculate, South American hunter-gatherers had already been adopted and gifted with useful know-how in much the same way that Clovis appears to have been. Even if the human story is badly broken in North America, with big pieces obviously missing, it's possible that a more complete account awaits us in the Amazon. I can hear the mainstream protests already. The whole idea of a lost civilization is nonsense, pseudoscience, a waste of research funds. But the mainstream, which has wasted research funds for decades, fruitlessly pursuing nonsensical fantasies like Clovis I, should have learned by now to keep an open mind.